Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
June 6, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and I just turned my head to look at it, actually, because I wanted to remember that it is the anniversary of D-Day and a few other things, but we're not doing this day in history. It is the first broadcast day of the week on the O'Shelly Effect, so welcome to Monday. Of course, most of you will be catching this further on down the stream via your final slab of choice, your applicable application, and your podcatcher du jour. Either way, no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, welcome. So, I love having authors on the show. I've had a little bit of trouble getting this one, so we're gonna get right to that in just a second. But anyway, things happen. It's a weird age, and a lot of cancellations from people I wouldn't expect to even cancel. Now, Jefferson Morley, I have met him in person. I have seen many of his presentations. I found many a thing he did valuable regarding the JFK assassination. Now, that is not the only thing that Jefferson Morley has ever written about. Not by a long shot. If you don't know who he is, I don't know what to tell you except welcome to planet Earth in the English language. Even in 2017, frankly, when the documents were supposed to be released again, right, and we were waiting for a document dump, I'll tell you, I don't know if Jefferson Morley knows this, but a campaign of annoying people decided to barrage the individuals at CNN and some other news outlets because they immediately hauled out the likes of Jared Posner and things like this, and we knew they were gonna when it came to the document dumps with JFK, which, by the way, JFK is not even necessarily a topic of discussion for tonight. But as soon as we saw that, we demanded that they come up with somebody logical, rational, and not entirely out there seeming to be, let's say, under the control of those that wish to push the official narrative. Okay. Uh-huh. Jefferson Morley was certainly one of those guys that we said, listen, you want logical, you want mainstream, you don't want the wild individual like me to, you know, come on there. Fine. At least get Jefferson Morley to be, and the next thing we knew, you were there. Now, I don't know if it had anything to do with a couple of hundred of us barraging them with emails or not.
I think quite possibly. But, quite possibly. Thank you for that effort. Yeah, every little bit helps.
Well, you know, listen, I appreciate your thanks, but we did that for us, not you. I just want you to know, because nobody wanted to see Posner again. Okay, sorry. Yeah. Anyway, I know I'm going way off topic here, but don't worry, we're going to get to it, because you have a book coming out, and I'm really glad to see my good friend J.G. Michael also had a discussion with you. Now, he doesn't do a live show, but his podcast, incredibly interesting array of guests and thoughtful, intellectual, and great material he always has on there. So I wasn't surprised to see you as a guest over with Parallax Views.
Yes, but it was a good conversation.
Yeah, no, he's great. Younger than me, I'm you know, happy to say. I mean, I'm only 50, but you know, these youngins, they're doing it a little differently, Mr. Morley. Anyways, no, the topic of tonight's discussion, and believe me, I'm going to shut up because I want to hear from you. It's just I'm doing my obligatory, you know, got to run my mouth to start with. The talk show host talks. Here's the thing. I thought of one thing when I saw the title for this book. And I was really glad, actually, that you contacted me yourself to come on and do this, because I was like, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, you have major publishers. There are people that usually you got to work through to get on and all that, and I was just like, oh, I'm real happy if you want to come on and talk about this. And I hadn't even seen word one in the book. Now, I have been reading it, and I've only gotten about halfway through, honestly. Okay. But I wanted to take my time, and also, I could have had the audiobook, and I didn't want the audiobook. I wanted to read it so I could see your notes. Okay. Because I know that you're not going to print things without backing them up, and that's something people need to keep in mind. Scorpion's Dance, first of all, nice title, and also the scheme on the front of the book, this black, red, and off-white. Always love that primary color scheme. But there's a little more to it, and there's an artistic end to that. I don't know if you had anything to do with that.
That was really St. Martin's Press came up with that idea, and I thought it was striking. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, I like it. I kind of wish the spine didn't go with the red because it's hard for me to read, but my eyes suck, so I have a unique set of complaints. but other than that, even when you're telling the story in here, wait, let me not get ahead of myself. Okay. And again, Scorpion's Dance, the President, the Spy Master, and Watergate. All right. What are we writing about? You've written about in the past James Jesus Angleton, if I can get it out of my mouth. You've written mm-hmm. about him, a book called The Ghost, right?
Yes.
Go ahead.
So, you know, yeah, how did this book come about? Well, one way to look at it is this is the third in a trilogy of spies. Mm-hmm. My first book was Our Man in Mexico, the story of Wynne Scott, the CIA's top man in Mexico in the 1960s. And then The Ghost, which you reference, is the story of James Angleton, the counterintelligence chief at the CIA from 1954 to 1974. And then this third book is about another CIA man, Richard Helms, who was career CIA officer and director of the CIA from 1966 to 1973. So mm-hmm. these three books really fit together. These are three leading personalities of the CIA in its first 25 years of existence, so they're important in the formation, the creation, the growth, the power of the CIA. So that's one way to look at this book. Another way to look at the book is I was interested, I knew the anniversary of Watergate was coming a few years ago, and I decided that it would be interesting to look at the Watergate affair, the scandal that led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon, not just as a chapter in the history of Richard Nixon's career and his presidency, but as a chapter in the history of the CIA. Because, of course, the burglars who were arrested at the Watergate affair, the thing that sets the whole scandal in motion, five of the seven burglars had worked for the CIA. So that's another frame for this story. But the idea is to look at the hidden hand of the CIA in these events and try and explain, what do we know now that we didn't know then, you know, when the story first broke?
Well, and, you know, in case somebody doesn't understand exactly how fascinating a character Richard Helms should be, I mean, outside of what you just said, okay, I want to give people a couple of points of reference. If you're saying, okay, Dick Helms, you know, why is he even an important guy? Of course, yeah, he's a spook, this and that, and clearly somebody who's, you know, on the letterhead sometimes when it comes to the CIA, when you're reading historical documents, okay. There's other things that go on here. Helms is the guy who is responsible for really what ends up becoming our knowledge about MKUltra. He's a guy questioned. Now, I'm not saying that he did anything real super helpful, but he did do the MK search deal. We come up with the financial documents. Those things are forensically recreated. That's not necessarily a component here in this discussion. But what I'm trying to say is that Helms is more than just the character most people present him as.
And, yes. Yeah. Yeah. He's a very influential, important figure in the history of the CIA. Mm-hmm. Not the least because he's director for close to 7 years. That's a very long tenure for a CIA director in historical times. And yes, he was involved in the creation and the maintenance of the MKUltra over 20 years, the MKUltra being the CIA's experiments to try and find out ways to control people's minds. Right. Really a terrible thing because of, you know, using LSD on people who didn't know what was being done to them. It's really unethical, and in these days it would be criminal. Mm-hmm. Helms was deeply involved in that, and then when it was on the brink of being discovered, he's the one who destroyed most of the records, and so we never got the full story of MKUltra. Like you said, we only got the financial records, so mm-hmm. we don't really have the full truth of what he did. But yes, a very important figure, not just, you know, some guy who had a job for a few years.
No, absolutely true. And I'll tell you something for the public's consumption. And this is going to sound weird, and this will be the last thing that I really want to get into before we get into why this is important. Well, two things, really. You know, first of all, I read a book somewhere in the 80s, and I think it was called Secret Agenda, which gave me an entirely different view on Watergate. And again, I was a teenager at the time and all that, but, you know, I had a historical sense of Watergate and Nixon and all that, and we'll get into this in a second, but another thing happened at a certain point when I saw an Oliver Stone film, and no, I'm not going with JFK here, Nixon.
Yeah.
Now, the theatrical release didn't include this sequence, or maybe it didn't include the whole sequence, as I remember, of Sam Waterston playing Dick Helms. Now, he doesn't remember him. He doesn't resemble him, at all, you know, physically. But I'll tell you something. He completely embodied exactly what I think of Helms after a long historical journey through things. And Anthony Hopkins playing Richard Nixon, again, didn't necessarily completely resemble him, but he captured him. And these two, in this one scene where, you know, the Helms character is you know, spritzing orchids and having a discussion with Nixon, even though this is not necessarily a historical recreation of any kind.
No.
It totally represents.
But a very compelling scene and speaks right to what I talk about in Scorpion's Dance, which is this very tricky relationship between these two men who, you know, are masters at keeping secrets and leveraging them and using them to, you know, to their own power. And they're both working on each other in this way. You know, they're trying to get advantage over each other, get the other to do their bidding and their will. And the scene that's depicted in the movie, in the director's cut of Nixon, when I wrote this book, that it was with that, almost with that scene in mind, that this was the core of it, the relationship between these two men face to face, you know, in the very tricky, subtle maneuverings of men of power.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that's the interesting thing is that I could not help, as I'm reading your book, and even when I saw the title, honestly, I thought of that scene.
Yeah,
you know, and frankly, it is better than any scene he had in JFK that Stone created there. The whole thing is perfect. The atmosphere, the odd color scheme, the orchids, the look in Waterston's eyes kills me there. Like, his eyes are solid dark as he makes certain statements. Well, you know, and I don't even remember. I don't have the lines memorized, but basically, when you're watching them dance back and forth, like, literally, one of them is stepping a little more forward, the other one's stepping back. I said to myself, Morley had to have thought of this while he was doing, because, again, you know, today, if you see Nixon on cable or something else, the scene's in there, but it wasn't initially in there, and it was in the director's cut, as you said, I think, when they first did the DVD or whatever. Doesn't matter. When I saw that scene, I was like, how could you have even cut this? This is brilliant. You know, and
well,
completely,
so
yeah.
I you haven't reached the point in the book, but I tell the story of what happened, which is Helms got a copy of the script before the movie was made, and he threatened to sue. He got a high-powered lawyer, and they wrote a letter to Stone, and they said, you know, complaining about that scene, and saying this is libelous, and, you know, please take it out of your movie. Stone shared the letter with me. What he said, what Stone told me was, I did cut it not because of the threat of litigation, but because we just had a very long movie and I had to cut something. And he pointed out, he said, I put it in the director's cut and Helms never sued. So I thought Oliver was saying, you know, like, I called his bluff. And what he said was true. Helms never sued. So
he told somebody, I got this secondhand from somebody, he might have told you this, but I never get to speak to Oliver Stone, but he told somebody I know fairly well who would report this accurately, that that he felt at the time maybe that it actually didn't fit in the movie, like it wasn't it just didn't work with the continuity of what he was going for. And it was really an artistic choice more than anything, even regardless of whatever pressures.
Yeah, that's what he was saying to me.
Oh, okay.
It was cut for reasons of length. It wasn't necessary for you know, the theatrical release of the movie.
Yeah.
So,
and of course, yeah, people, and people panned certain parts of Nixon because, oh, he's drinking too much and this and that, but they didn't recognize that it was a repetitive beat of the same night, you know. And I'm going, ah, come on, you know, you're picking a, and really, I think Nixon is a even a superior film to JFK, even though, you know, obviously it's got a spot in my heart always. But either way, let's get away from that. But there is inspiration, though, and if you don't understand what it is you're going to read in this book, this again for the listeners, I would find that scene, even if you got to even just find it on YouTube or something, watch it carefully, because it is really well done and embodies what's in this book. So let's get back to the book, though, because some people would say, all right, well, yeah, we do have the 50th anniversary, and right now, I mean, even as we speak, what is it? They're doing a series of documentaries, I guess, pseudo-documentaries on CNN. I keep bringing up CNN because they got a lot of reach at this point outside of just being a news agency. They create all kinds of stuff,
right?
You know, and so they're doing a whole thing with John Dean, and it is relevant to remember this, but there is a public face of what happened with Watergate. And then there's the rest of the story, as a radio guy used to say, right? And you are giving us, by the way, the thing is, you're giving us the public stuff. And you're telling a story in here. And I really did, this is going to sound kind of crappy, but I really forgot that you knew how to tell a story so well, because Our Man in Mexico is a very well-written piece like this, too. And you know, again, I forgot that. I mean, you can be a great journalist and get at the facts and everything else and not know how to tell a story. You're telling a story in here, which gives us...
Yeah, no, and it's a good story. And it's not a story, like I say, what do we know now that we didn't know then? This story that I tell, the CIA's hand in the whole Watergate affair, wherever it might be felt... was much more important than was known at the time. The things that were going on with the CIA shaped the way the public understood the story in ways that were to the advantage of the CIA. And that's really, you know, when you look at the Helms-Nixon relationship, that was its impact on the scandal, was that the hand of the CIA stayed hidden. Nixon's hand didn't stay hidden, which is why he had to resign.
Right.
But the CIA's hand did stay hidden.
Well, and some people would say, well, but Mr. Morley, the CIA's hand couldn't have stayed hidden. I mean, Howard Hunt is there, and G.
Yes,
Gordon Liddy is there,
but that's a different...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, no, everybody understood that the CIA was, you know, that these were former CIA people, but the CIA's cover story, articulated by Helms, that we really didn't know what these men were doing, that was false. And my book, Scorpion's Dance, shows that pretty clearly. Mm-hmm. Helms was much more knowledgeable about the burglars individually than he ever let on. Howard Hunt was, in fact, a good buddy of his. They, you know, had worked together and had lunch together, and Helms did favors for him, and Hunt, you know, sent him a wedding gift. These guys were buddy-buddy. That was not known at the time of Watergate. Yes, that Howard Hunt was CIA, sure, people knew that. They didn't know that he was buddy-buddy with the director who was denying knowledge of anything that was going on. Likewise, Jim McCord, one of the other burglars, senior officer in the office, the CIA's Office of Security, which is the Office of Security is like the CIA's internal police force. Mm-hmm. They secure the agency's property. You know, they make sure you don't have classified documents on your desk. They vet new employees to make sure that they're not a security risk. So a very sensitive position. McCord held a senior position in the Office of Security. And when he retired and went into business as a private, you know, security consultant, which is how he wound up being one of the burglars, he had on his wall a signed autographed picture of Dick Helms that said, "With deep appreciation, signed Dick Helms." So McCord was also very close with Helms. And this was not really known at the time.
Well, another thing that was not really known at the time, again, it's superficial, the idea that, you know, okay, yeah, these guys are connected to the CIA, they're former CIA, this and that. You also have a guy like Liddy in there, who is, you know, not CIA, to my mind, okay, but a whole other kind of animal that makes perfect sense in the soup that is the CIA, though. And, you know, I mean, everybody points to his quirks and his public stuff, which he did, which, you know, I don't know, seemed to have been forgotten for like 40 years.
Yeah.
You know, even though the guy had a radio show and all that other stuff, which is the only time I got to speak to him is when he had the G. Gordon Liddy show.
Well, he was a popular guy.
Yeah.
You know, he parlayed that his conviction into a commercial career.
Yeah, he did. But, you know, the fascinating thing and the shocking thing to me is that, okay, let's go back to the burglary really quickly. And again, this is not something that you have so far in the book hovered on like some other people do. And they get into all the minutiae of it and they really drive you nuts. But you know what? Sometimes that's valuable because forgotten in here is that some of the guys that were, you know, security consultants that were hired, that were part of this, that were, you know, deployed, you know, with this off-the-shelf sort of operation that that Nixon had. Well, you know, some of these guys who flubbed this, you know, what was called a third-rate burglary by a lot of people, had no business flubbing it because some of them literally would instruct CIA guys how to do stuff like this. There were others who, as you said, were in positions of authority over things that should have been bought. Like, in other words, this is the team that should not have screwed this up and gotten busted and ended up, you know, a security guard figures something out and, you know, they're crouching. What was the description? They're crouching behind tables or desks or something like that when the cops come in. This is not the group of guys that should have gotten busted this way. I mean,
well,
you know, to put it simply.
I must say, Howard Hunt did not have a good reputation inside the CIA. He had a reputation for insecure behavior and botched operations. So, you know, if you know Howard Hunt's career, the fact that this burglary was bungled, it's not that surprising. I mean, and some people say, you know, the bungling was deliberate. And, you know, it is hard to believe that these supposed professionals, you know, screwed this thing up. But it's also possible that, you know, they were arrogant and, you know, and sloppy. Just to go back for a second, you mentioned a book before, Secret Agenda by Jim Hogan. And I want to cite that book as, I wouldn't say the inspiration for this book, but Secret Agenda was published a few years after the Watergate scandal in the late 1970s. And Hogan went back and just looked at all the evidence and didn't really kind of develop any grand theory of what was going on, except to say, you know, the Washington Post narrative, which was becomes embedded in the movie All the President's Men, you know, that really didn't explain a lot of things that were happening and that had happened in the break-in and in the cover-up and in the personalities involved. And so I look at my book as kind of son of Secret Agenda, which I develop some of the leads and give more context and provide a lot of new information about those same topics that Hogan raised, but flesh them out a little bit more and explain more what were the secret agendas in going on in Watergate.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. No, I agree with you. And again, I've only gotten halfway through and I absolutely agree with you. And I'm waiting. I'm sure there's going to be more to. And it's not because, again, it's not an engaging and enthralling read. It's simply because I've had to go back over a couple of things, to be honest with you, where I'm like, wait a minute. Let me go back here a second.
It is a complex story. And there's a lot of threads to keep in, you know, to keep in mind. And so, yeah, it does take a little work to absorb the complexity of it.
Right.
You know, these are very complex operators. You know, Richard Helms and Richard Nixon, extremely intelligent men. You know, vast history, very devious. So, you know, you have multiple agendas and styles working at all times.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, makes it a very rich and, you know, disturbing picture.
No, absolutely true. And you've now said it more eloquently than I could have. And it is exactly as you describe it. And I got to tell you, it's just, yeah, it's an absolute essential. If you appreciate looking at something from another angle and you're not just satisfied with the, again, the very pedestrian sort of view which is presented. You know, what are you going to get? The obligatory, here's what Walter Cronkite presented on the news about this. And, of course, Woodward, Bernstein, the legends were made here. And, yeah, a lot more to this story. Okay.
Yes. Definitely.
That's, you know, being generous right there, right? Some other people have made other statements. I don't go there. Look, I'm not going to speculate about people's motives. The times were different for sure. You know,
that's an important thing to understand, that, you know, at that time we hadn't had all the experience that we had now. You know, the CIA had not been investigated by the Church Committee. We had not lost in Vietnam yet. You know, we didn't have the experience of the Iran-Contra affair. You know, people, it was a more innocent time, and so people were more shocked by the revelations. You know, when we look back on this time, you see many similarities to our time, but you also see, you know, very different things.
Mm-hmm. No, all true. And again, even when Helms has shown up in public, which you now referenced a couple of times, he shows up in public during certain hearings, you know, and all this kind of stuff. I don't think he's ever been really adequately explored. And the opinions, I mean, I know there's been entire volumes written about him, and I respect people's work, but frankly, I don't think anybody has gotten at it like you have here.
It's
a different angle, and it's not even like you're trying to go look at the nefarious, scary man. You're not doing that either, but you're presenting this in a way. And by the way, there's something else that goes on in this book where, frankly, a lot of authors, they try to give you the voice of the individuals they're writing about, so they quote them, and they tell you about what it is they're saying, and they tell you, they lay out a meeting or an event, and they give you a landscape. Okay, so you do this in this book, but you also retain their voices separately, which not an easy thing to do. And sometimes you do it with very simple methods, like the Southern drawl of one a particular individual stands out to me, where you actually you at first I thought it was a misprint, L-A-H-K, lack. Okay, I'm just, you know, going with that. And it's a great piece, by the way. When you see the LAHK quote come up in the book, pay careful attention to the interplay that's going on there, because you also quote or represent what Nixon is saying. I think even, well, one of the best lines in the book is right there, and I won't give it away. But, you know, so far, this idea about what Nixon's attitude was at this time, because that's another thing. You're not just focused on Helms. You actually do give us a view of both of the dance partners.
In the introduction, I say this is a biography of power. So it's the biography of the power wielded by these two men. Mm-hmm. And so it's the story of their relationship from beginning to end. And it really is about not one or the other, but about what's going on with both of them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I literally feel as though I am witnessing the dance. Now, I'm not sure who the scorpion is sometimes, but, you know, that's another thing. The idea that Nixon has this idea, this very, again, sort of mainstream idea, and yet outside of the mainstream idea about power and how the government's supposed to work and all that kind of stuff. I mean, embodied, obviously, in the quotes that people point to. You know, if the president does it, then it's not illegal. That kind of stuff. Yes, true. But it goes a little further than that. He has a very, I don't know, almost like a Boy Scout view of certain things, despite the fact that he's seen as one of the most corrupt, blah, blah, which, by the way, I think, I don't know if you're going to agree with this. I think that maybe history had been a little too harsh on him, because I don't think he's even remotely the most corrupt guy to ever be in that office. He just got caught. But other than
I mean, Woodward and Bernstein had a big piece in the Post yesterday, comparing Nixon to Trump, and they were saying, you know, we thought Nixon was corrupt and abusing the powers of the office, but you know, he was nothing. Nixon had a conscience in a way. You talk about, you mentioned, like, he had a Boy Scout, like, there was a certain very earnest quality to Nixon that was not cynical. I mean, yes, he was a devious, you know, mean man in a lot of ways, but there was also this earnest, awkward quality to him. And I, I mean, I tried to bring out those things when writing about that. You know, yeah, people could be critical of Dick Helms and Dick Nixon, but, you know, a lot of people like them. So whatever my personal opinion is, I want to present them with a 360-degree point of view so that no matter what you think of him, whatever your opinion, political opinion is, left, right, or center, you see that person the way he was seen by others at that time. You know, and over the course of the book, you'll get a sense of what my personal opinion is, how I would judge these guys. But I don't want to do the judging for the readers. I want the readers to see these men as much as possible, you know, in some kind of context. So I try to give them credit for their good points, you know, and at the same time, you know, being critical of what they deserve to be criticized for.
Oh, yeah, and that's the thing I was going to say. I don't get a sense that you're trying to lean on the scale here to, you know, look at how bad this is, you know. Yeah. You're just telling the story and letting it unfold, and it's really interesting because there's a lot of nuance in here, and again, you are constructing this in a way that is not like a dry read, okay, so on this date this happened, on this date this happened. It's not like that, which there's value in that stuff. But honestly, right, there's also value in keeping me interested in the story itself, even if I think I already know the story, honestly. Right. In reading your book, I'm going, yeah, well, maybe not. I get lost in it. I like it. I really do. And I like that the voices of not only the main individuals involved here, but even that reference, you know, where I like this, you know, the what is that, Moore, I think, right?
Yeah, he was the chief of staff, so he was giving a briefing in his Virginia draw on, he was giving a briefing on Vietnam. That's what you're quoting from.
Yeah.
But that was, I mean, I get that from the tape of the meeting, but, you know, when you listen to the meeting, oh, okay, you know, there's the Southern military officer, you know, there's the Southern general or admiral, whatever he was, you know, given a briefing with his Southern accent, you know, that I wanted to put the reader in the room there with those guys.
Yeah. See, but that's what I was going to say. You actually do that. And that's not the only point at which you do it. There are various times where I am picturing the particular situation, even if you're not lingering on it too long, I actually can capture a snapshot in my mind, which is something, again, not every author and honestly, not the majority of authors are capable of doing. Many of them fail to do so. I'm very tough on this stuff because I'm sick of people writing the same thing over and over again and putting their name on it.
Yeah,
is what it is. And you don't do that. You never have. So I want to acknowledge that. But this is remarkable because I'm telling the, you know, if you read this, you're going to at various times get sucked into the what's happening. You're in the scene of what's occurring here. You're literally able to generate from what Jefferson Morley has written here, an entire scene, and not drowning us in details, but giving you enough of the portrait that you can get a sense of this circumstance, this situation. And it's not just a one-off. What happens is he's actually interlocking these things so that you can sensibly move from one to the other, which I just wanted to compliment you on that. That is...
Oh, well, thank you for that. Thank you for that.
That's a rare, rare thing. So so thank you for that. But so look, enough out of me again, because let's get into the rest of... we got the why. We got some of the inspiration. Okay. Yeah. What did you find challenging, though, here? Because you do go in slightly odd directions for somebody who maybe thinks that they're familiar with the literature on this, that they might know this circumstance, but you did it coherently. We're going in a lot of, like I said, like you said, loads of threads here, and I'm only halfway through. But it doesn't overwhelm the reader. Don't think it overwhelms you. It's complicated enough that it is a full intellectual journey, okay? But it's not so overwhelming that, you know, I'm trying to figure out what shoes Martha Mitchell's wearing, okay? We're not doing that, okay?
Right. Well, yeah. You know, there's a couple things. One is the discipline that I tried to keep, right? Watergate is a sprawling story. You know, there's campaign finance, and there's the break-in, and there's the cover-up, and there's the White House people, and, you know, there's the hearings. You know, it kind of spreads in all directions. So this book really focuses on these two men's relationship and what takes place between them as far as the Watergate scandal and its impact and the resignations and the politics and the convictions and the hearings, all of that, but always through the eyes of these two men. So I don't get caught up in all of the other things. You can follow this story all the way through. Yes, there's complexities about their relationship and all of that. So that's one thing. A second thing, though, that I think you'll find from this book is, this is my journalistic background, right? I mean, I'm halfway between a journalist and a historian, but as a journalist, I really prize and work on what's the thing that's really new. You know, what I come back to it again. What do we know now that we didn't know then? Mm-hmm. Because if you think about the daily news business, what do? You know, we write, what's the newest thing that happened? And that's right at the top of your story, right? Whether you're reading your story or whether you're writing it, you know, at the top of the story, you're saying, what's new? And then you put yesterday's facts, the rest of the story, down below. And then at the bottom of that, you put your correction, you know, where you messed up. So I'm looking to put, you know, new things out there. And, you know, if you read this book, like there's in most chapters, there's like a little story or vignette or something that's never been written about before. So to give you one small example, mm-hmm. to illustrate the friendship of Richard Helms and Howard Hunt, the burglar in chief. In 1963, Hunt's wife was worked as a translator for the Spanish ambassador in the United States, Dorothy Hunt. And so she was a spy too. She started stealing stuff off the ambassador's desk, like his calendar and his plans, his correspondence. And she fed that back to her husband, and it went back to the CIA. And this was, you know, potentially valuable stuff. What did the Spanish government think about U.S. policy? What did they think about President Kennedy? So Dorothy Hunt, you know, kind of wanted to be in the business too, and Howard was supportive of it. So this information goes back to Helms. Some people inside the CIA said, wait a second, we can't be spying on U.S. soil. That's a violation of the CIA's charter, right? Mm-hmm. So we really shouldn't be doing this, you know, and they send the message up to Helms, the deputy director, you know, we shouldn't do this. Call off Dorothy. Tell Hunt no go. Helms overrules his subordinates and rules in favor of his friend, Howard Hunt, and says, yes, Dorothy can keep doing this, you know, and so she keeps on doing it for, you know, a few more months. And then she had a child and she was sort of out of that business. But in a pinch, Helms comes to the rescue of Hunt's wife, right? That's a story that nobody's ever written about before. I found it in some old congressional documents, where it was written about in very well-documented detail. So, like, in every chapter, you're going to get something like that, like something that's really you didn't know before, like about, you know, Jim McCord, about that Jim McCord had a picture of Richard Helms in his office. Not a huge fact, but it does tell you something about them. You know, it does tell you something about the story.
Well, yeah, so, these are little details that fill in that mosaic, like I said, that allow you to draw this picture. Now I can, you know, I'm putting that picture on the wall in my mind.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so it has some significance because it speaks to the mentality. But, you know, continue on, because I actually have a question about this.
Sure.
Because for years and years, and I'll ask my question, let you continue on about what you're talking about here with Hunt and Helms and their relationship. I've heard lots of rumors about all kinds of stuff that Helms might have done on Hunt's behalf to keep him, well, from maybe getting in trouble for the fact that he was hapless on a lot of operations. You know, everybody thinks of him as this great master spy, you know, and in some cases he was, but in other cases he was not so consistent.
Not at all.
And people, you know, they hear Dorothy Hunt and immediately they're going to want to ask about the plane crash and what was going on there. How much did Hunt really involve his family? Of course, because of, you know, the later stories we've gotten from St. John Hunt, et cetera. About, you know,
So Dorothy Hunt dies in a plane crash in December 1972 while her husband's in jail, and $10,000 is found in her purse in the crash. And mm-hmm. So, you know, some people say, you know, the crash was sabotage, it was deliberate, she was killed. You know, I looked into that. I didn't find any basis for that. It was the National Transportation Board investigated, and concluded it was pilot error. I didn't find any reason to doubt that finding. The theories that, you know, that it was sabotage and she was killed for some reason. Mm-hmm. I didn't find anything to support that. That was pure speculation. The money in her purse probably was significant in the sense that she may have been paying off some of her husband's debts related to buying equipment for the burglars. That's probably why she was carrying that much money. Howard Hunt's explanation of why she was carrying the money was not plausible, and it seemed like a cover story. I interviewed St. John Hunt for the book. He and I don't agree on all of those things, but he liked the book very much, I should say. Mm-hmm. I think because it was a well-rounded portrait of his father and of the times that he lived in.
Well, right. No, I only bring up St. John, you know, and I don't want to, devolve into what he had to say about JFK or anything. What I want to do, though, is just point out that St. John talked about, you know, being involved directly in some of his father's operations. So it is an open question as to exactly how involved maybe Howard Hunt's family had been at different points in time. And he was certainly an active guy.
Dorothy was very, you know, was very knowledgeable and supportive of his espionage work and all of that. And especially after he was arrested, she was really kind of running interference and collecting hush money for him and badgering the White House for the kind of support that he thought he needed. Right. Dorothy Hunt was very much a partner with Howard Hunt in this business.
Oh, yeah, but in that way, that doesn't make her some sort of spy in and of herself. I mean, I'm just saying that this, in certain ways, this is the wife doing the bidding of the husband, who is either in custody, under surveillance, etc. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to break this down, I'm saying, but... that's something that I do think needs to be addressed, and you do get at it. And if St. John liked it, you know, that's great. But I'm just referring to, he's told stories about being a teenager and destroying evidence and, and other stuff like this. And I'm not saying he's truthful or not. I'm not putting a judgment on it. I'm just saying that if you accept that that's even a possibility, you got to view E. Howard Hunt in a few different ways here. And one of the ways, as you mentioned, you know, he gives a cover story about why she has the money. Well, he's given cover stories about a lot of things, some of them more successful than others. But clearly, you know, not being upfront, let's say, when it comes to when he's questioned about various things. So, you know, here we go. That's the character you're dealing with. And I'm not doing this to run even E. Howard Hunt down. I'm just saying that was the business he was in, is disinformation. And eluding, you know, allowing the light of day to be shown on a lot of things he was involved in. And I think that's a fair assessment. Back to this, though, where you're talking about what's going on between these two. But I've heard for years that Helms, you know, if it wasn't for Helms protecting Hunt in a lot of cases, there might have been wholly different outcomes anyway.
So I show that very clearly in the book, very clearly. When Hunt is about to be fired in February 1970 for breaking CIA rules, mm-hmm. by not clearing a manuscript that he had written for publication, even then, all the top people around Helms wanted him gone. And so Helms can't save his job, but he writes a letter of recommendation for Hunt. Mm-hmm. And that enables Hunt to get a job at the Mullen Company, a Washington public relations firm. So even at the very end of his career, Helms extricates Hunt from, you know, self-induced problems. Hmm.
And just for the listener, because you mentioned there, you know, he didn't get a manuscript approved. Maybe not everybody knows this, but if you were somebody who worked for the CIA and you're writing just about anything, you know what? You end up having to get it cleared by the agency, don't you?
Yes.
You know, and well, you've written about Winscott. So, you know, we all know that there was a manuscript which circulated, having to do with Winscott, right?
Yeah, no, and that was a similar case where Winscott had not submitted that for what they call pre-publication review. Mm-hmm. That's the process that you allude to. If you are a CIA employee and you want to write anything, part of your contract says you have to clear that manuscript with the agency before you can publish it, and the agency has the right to, you know, redact or withhold any information as it sees fit. So, you know, yeah, Wynn Scott did not do that in my first book, in telling the Wynn Scott story, and Howard Hunt did not do that, and I tell that story in Scorpion's Dance.
Right, right. No, I just wanted to mention that because I thought that was relevant. And again, I know you and I know these things, but it's better if somebody like you explains it. It's worth mentioning. Right. Okay. So moving forward, you have the public face here. And again, you do represent that. We're not just going completely, under the covers here, so to speak, but we are going under the covers, okay, in this story. And I really like that because it gives you, again, what you said you were aiming at, which is a 360-degree angle of all of what's going on here and the interplay between these two. So ultimately, outside of refining our view of history here, regarding these events, which I think is going to be a continuous process, as are most controversial things in history anyway, and certainly with the postmodern age of historical writing, you know, without giving the old the French concept of perspective, right? Over time, where you're supposed to allow 75 years before you can adequately write about something, yeah, we don't do that anymore. Rise and fall of the Third Reich, I think, ended that whole discussion. But, of course, JFK and the literature therein, for better or worse, has, if there was any discussion, it's over. We have this idea about writing about things as they have just happened. And it's not just there either. I mean, how many Trump, presidency books are out? You know what I'm saying?
So, yeah, dozens.
You know, we're at that point. So you're in this trajectory now of the literature where, you know, over time, again, these things are being revised and being reexamined as they should be. But you've really made a step forward here. And again, I do think it's a companion. And I remember that book in the 80s. Again, it might have been published in the 70s, the Hogan book. But this is a logical companion to it, and not too many people have done what, or even attempted, to do. I don't think anybody's done this, but nobody has really attempted to add on to that story so well, I would say, in decades. So this is a unique view. All right, Scorpion's Dance. I'm doing this for the listener, not you. This is a unique view, and it's extremely well written. Again, I can't stress that enough. Okay, so as you're going through this, and you know you're contributing to that literature, right?
Yeah.
And you said half a historian, half a journalist, so you might have to argue with yourself here about how far you've been able to go. What do you think could have been revealed or dug up that maybe you weren't able to get to here that could flesh this out even more? Do you think you missed anything so far? I mean, up to this point, probably not. But then again, might come out. Go ahead.
When you enter into a book like this, especially on a short deadline, right? I got this book contract in 2019, and I knew that I had to be done by, if you want to get a book out in June 2022, you basically have to have a pretty complete manuscript handed in 12 months before. Okay, so I started in this fall of 2019, and I had to be done by June 2021. So there's things that, you know, I couldn't pursue, you know, and the pandemic happens. I cannot go to the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, California, which was, you know, like the first stop I was going to make. That library was completely closed for the entire pandemic. And unlike a lot of libraries, they did not take requests for documents. You know, some library, presidential libraries like JFK or Ford Library, you know, you identify a document in their collection and you say, could you make a scan of this? And you pay 25 cents or something for it, you know, and they send you a photocopy or a PDF. The Nixon Library didn't do anything like that. And so there was this whole correspondence that Nixon had between 1960 and 1968, what he called the wilderness years. He was in the political wilderness. You know, people thought Nixon was a has-been. They thought he was finished. And he was, you know, always constantly maneuvering to get back into the White House, and he ultimately succeeded. But I never got the correspondence of the Wilderness Years, and I thought that would have been very interesting to find out about. I wanted to know more about what he brought into the relationship with Nixon and how he conceived his path back to power. So that was one thing that I was, you know, frustrated or disappointed, or I wished I could have done more with it, and I never had the opportunity. So to answer your question, that's one thing that, you know, I didn't get, you know, that I was hoping for. You know, I'm trying to always try and get those new nuggets of information, something that hasn't been on the record before or reported or in any book before. If I had access to that Wilderness Years, I think I would have found some more newsworthy things.
Well, yeah, and look, it might actually be something that you need for the update of this book sometime in the future, because
yeah.
Here's the thing about it, and I'm not criticizing you, by the way. What I'm saying is that people need to consider that, look, this is a guy who goes from being vice president. He's, clearly involved in the corridors of power, not just on the surface level, but in other ways, because he's the action officer, right, for the White House during his tenure as vice president. Now, he loses the election in 60. Narrowly to Kennedy, and of course we know famously that certainly affected his psychology, his behaviors ever after. But he also loses trying to run for governor of California, which, you know, that's where he's like seemingly finished as far as the public's concerned.
Right.
And then he goes back into business as a lawyer. He's working for, what is it, Pepsi or Coke? I don't even know. But either way,
Pepsi.
You know, Pepsi, I'm making a joke, I know. But the thing is, I mean, because believe me, I know the whole thing. He was in Dallas, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So, look, it's an interesting time period, though, because for the public's view or the public's consumption, he's out. He's completely out of the circle, completely out of the loop. But you and I both know that one of these guys, especially if they reemerge in a position of power later, they weren't really out of the loop.
Nixon had his eye on the prize the whole time. He never woke up for a day between 1960 and 1968 not thinking, I am running for president. From the moment he lost, even after he lost that governor's race in California, you know, the guy, he never quit. He was crushed. People mocked him and laughed him. And he himself said famously at the press conference, the press, you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore. You know, very self-pitying and, you know, like, and that's why people thought this guy, he's a has-been, he's washed up, you know, he's a loser, he's a sore loser, you know. But even then, Nixon was thinking hard, how am I going to get back to be president? How am I going to win the Republican nomination? I mean, just scheming, advancing, maneuvering every day, everything he did was to advance his path back to power. Right. Nixon was very relentless in that way. A lot of our presidents have been that way. You know, that will to power, that tremendous will to power. Nixon definitely had it. Mm.
And, you know, the nuances of that, again, I don't know if they're fully fleshed out, but another nod to Oliver Stone in the movie Nixon with the interactions between Hopkins and the I can't remember the actress playing Pat Nixon, but either way, between Nixon and, you know, Richard Nixon and Pat Nixon, you know, buddy, we deserve it. It's ours, you know, this kind of thing, which is weird. I'm not sure if he actually called her buddy and all that, but whatever. It's a dramatization. But it's interesting because I think it actually provides part of what is certainly publicly observable about his psychology, but might go deeper. Because this could contribute to, and this is an easy low-hanging argument, but this could contribute to the, extreme need to control stuff. I mean, why were the plumbers created in the first place? To stop leaks, to deal with, the whole thing with the Pentagon Papers and Ellsberg. Yeah, we know all that. But there might have been a deeper, motivation here.
What do you think?
What I'm saying is that, you know, it's not just about controlling it because, well, you know, I could lose in 72, or I think that it might have gone even further. Like, it was a, you wanting to win politically is one thing. Wanting to shut down your opponents is another. Wanting to bomb the Brookings Institute is a different level of intensity and is clearly not motivated by just wanting to win. That is a rather high-risk thing to even present to your people, right? Which I think it's provable that's something that could have happened. But some people argue. Maybe that isn't really what happened, and it's being exaggerated, and, you know, there you go again with the... I don't know. You know, I think there's something more to be said here where he changes. He still retains some of that Boy Scout, you know, again, the Boy Scout sort of mentality about this is the way things should work. But on the other hand, he also believes that he has a right to work way outside of that, which...
That's true. And I think I got a sense in doing the research for the book that Nixon had a very visceral reaction to the violence of the anti-war movement, of the bombings that were, you know, government offices were bombed, draft offices were bombed. Mm-hmm. It was almost like this little incipient guerrilla war in the United States. And that enraged Nixon and made him feel like, I'm entitled to do anything. You know, I can break the law. Because you're right, that when he's raging about the break into the Brookings Institution, I mean, with the exception of Trump, it's hard to imagine any president in American history sort of saying, you know, let's go out and do something totally illegal, you know, right now, you know, like in Washington, you know, like he was kind of mad. He was driven. I mean, to be generous about it, you would say he was driven mad by the times, you know, but he, there was this change, this turn in his behavior late into his presidency. And I think Watergate was a reflection of that. Mm-hmm.
No, certainly was a reflection. But see, people would think that that's the inciting incident. There's a lot that leads up to that, you know, yeah. And it's not just, again, the public failures. But I think there's a maybe yet another window we could get to here to really get inside of what's going on, because a lot's happening here at this point in time. And even if we go back to him, you know, getting in and getting into the office in 68, a lot of things had to occur for that to be possible. I don't think for a second that Nixon could have feasibly won against, say, like a Bobby Kennedy, okay, if that's his opponent.
Right.
I don't even know if he would have gotten in had Bobby Kennedy survived necessarily, right?
Who knows?
Would he have been taken seriously by the public, you know, without that?
Nixon was a very credible candidate. He was a very canny candidate. He might have beaten Bobby Kennedy.
Well, you know, we'll
he
never
might
know.
Have been able to portray Bobby Kennedy as too liberal, and he might have been able to win. I mean, I think Bobby Kennedy had his own strengths as a candidate, and but remember, the war by that time was very unpopular and associated with a Democratic president. So Nixon running as a Republican, you know, he might have defeated Bobby Kennedy. Of course, we'll never know.
Right. But I mean, but what I'm saying is, though, it's not a simple thing where a lot of people try and oversimplify it and say, well, Bobby Kennedy would have beaten him. I don't know, because like, as you said, a really strong strategy there could have turned public sentiment to like, listen, things are out of control. They have been out of control, and we can blame that on the Democrats. I mean, I know today that's like, you know, yawn. I get it. But but at that time, that could have been very significant. And with the proper push, you could have gotten anybody in there for sure. I mean, because it was kind of an unsteady time in American history, let's say, in 68. So
the most unsteady since the Civil War, and the most unsteady since our time today. I mean, the analogy of the late 60s, you know, in terms of polarization, destabilization, sense of uncertainty about the future in the political process, where are we going, what's going to happen. The times that we are in now, what they most closely resemble is the late 1960s and early 1970s in terms of mood. So That is a similarity between that time and this time.
I tell you, you start out with a quote from The Tempest, by the way, and I love that quote, and certainly love it when people use Shakespearean quotes in a certain way. But it's fascinating. It's an interesting way to begin the discussion, because I think that's what people expect that they're going to get in this book, which I don't have the quote in front of me. But either way, I could probably turn to it. I got the book in my hand, which is really great, by the way. And I would suggest the hard copy. You know, again, I'm sure I don't know what Audible did with your audio. I don't know who reads it. Do you read it, or does somebody else?
An actor reads it. I think the audiobook is very good. If you go to my website, JFK Facts, you can find a couple of the audio excerpts from the book. Yeah, the audiobook is good. If that's your thing, I'm not really a big audiobook user. I prefer to read hardcover books. But some people like that, and the audiobook is good.
Well, I personally like to do both, but I really wanted the physical book because, again, I wanted to see your notes because I know they're going to be fascinating. And, you know, because they always are. Anything that you write. I was going to send people to, I think it's Jefferson Morley Books, but they should go to JFK Facts to go check out these audio excerpts, because there's another website. I think it's JeffersonMorleyBooks.com or something like that.
But yeah, you can order my books there as well.
There you go. But you know what I'll do? I'll just put all that in the show notes, everybody. And so go ahead and scroll down. Also, there'll be a direct link, because it is available in audio, in hardcover, and also a digital form like Kindle and stuff like that. I'll give you guys the links to go get it. Directly also to the websites. Scorpion's Dance, okay, The President, The Spy Master, and Watergate. What else can you say? And it's an interesting book cover, by the way. There's like a limo in front of the White House. That's part of the visual aspect of it. And, you know, I meant to talk about this to begin with, and it'll just take you a minute over here. You know, unless you want to hang out with me for a little while, I got another hour, but either way, I just want to give you a chance to talk about this cover again, because I want people to go find it, and they will find it visually on the internet by seeing this cover, which is a black and white photo, has black bars through it. Now, the black bars, of course, look to me like exactly the kind of thing they do when they redact documents. And that's what it's meant to do. And if you open up the flap on the dust jacket, you'll see more of that kind of thing. Anyway, the black bars, then there's the title text is in red, okay, and it's over a black and white photograph, and also the off-white. So you have that, you know, black-white-red motif over the black and white photograph. And quite frankly, it's completely appropriate. And really interesting, like you would have thought, because you're focusing on these two guys, that somebody would have said, oh, put, you know, these pictures of each of their faces and let's do. And
No.
I'm glad they didn't do that.
I was very glad when they came up with this design, because those pictures, you know, those black and white pictures of, you know, men in suits and Watergate hearings and all that, that imagery is just not very interesting. And it doesn't. It doesn't evoke the time or the, you know, it doesn't evoke what was going on, the dynamics and the secrecy and the intrigue and the cover-up. And this kind of very enigmatic picture that suggests power but hidden power is much more evocative of what the book is actually about. So that's why I like it.
Yeah, no, I definitely like it. It's actually better than if they would have done, you know, the ghost images, or, you know, trying to lay them over top of something like, you know, the unrest of the year there or something, or, you know, maybe the Watergate hearings and their pictures. Who knows what they would have done if it was typical. This is nice. I like the way this is. So
if I could just say, you know, a couple of last things, Chuck. Well, first of all, if any of your listeners are in the Washington, D.C. area, I'm going to be appearing in person at the Politics and Prose Bookstore on Connecticut Avenue in Washington a week from tonight on Monday, June 13th. Also, I'm appearing at a remote event at the Spy Museum on the anniversary of the burglary on June 17th. And I'll be in conversation there with my friend James Rosen of Newsmax, who's also a Watergate author. and a friend, and we'll be talking for patrons of the Spy Museum. So that's going to be a very interesting conversation, and that's free and open to the public. You can go to the Spy Museum website and register for that event. So if people are interested in this topic and are interested in the book, that's two more places where they can kind of check in and hear conversation about what this book is about, what's new about it, what's interesting about it. So coming up in Politics and Prose in Washington a week from tonight, June 13th, and then a remote event at the Spy Museum on June 17th. So look for those.
Well, absolutely. And I'll tell you something else. I would definitely suggest and recommend other books by Jefferson Morley, but this one is interesting. Really interesting and really timely. I'm glad it came out when it did, and really happy to see it. You know, not just it, and it's not overwhelming either. It's not a very long book.
I tell you, Chuck, that's one thing I was aiming for. Was I did not want this to be a long book. This is like a book you can read on a long plane ride. It moves quickly. It's less than 300 pages long. It is well documented, like you say. If you have any questions, just check the notes and you'll know why I'm saying what I'm saying. But it's a good read. It's a thin book. It's it's fast paced.
Yeah, that's the other thing. It's very I always hate to say this about stuff that contains lots of historical reality, but it's very entertaining. Because listen, history is entertaining to me, otherwise I wouldn't read so many books about it, but some people, look, a pure historian, good thing you're not a pure historian, because most of them are not pure writers. They capture a lot of, I mean, everybody from, you know, all the names you know to even the late Roger Remington, who was a JFK author, who was a trained historian. Very dry, very, very dry reading. He did the one book where he was interacting with Bugliosi and all that. That's not so dry, but because that's, you know, different anecdotes and accounts. But I mean, literally, when he goes to write the history, it's solid, it's great, but hard to get through. No, this is actually an entertaining read, but also highly informative and, like you said, well documented. I've gone and I've checked a few of the notes so far. Just to give you, I'm bad like that. I'm really bad because
you got to do it.
I hate letting anybody, like, if I bring you on to talk about your book, if I think your book is a waste of time, guess what? I'm going to say it. And I'm going to say, look, you got some good stuff in here, but you waste my time for 300 pages. I'll tell you that. I'm halfway through. There is nothing wasted here. It's very interesting. It's a well-painted portraits in my, I'm able to visualize things here, like I said, and learn as I go. So anyway, Scorpion's Dance, The President, The Spy Master, and Watergate, Jefferson Morley, but also any of the books that have Jefferson Morley as an author are valuable, interesting, and informative all the way across. Not saying that I agree with everything Jefferson Morley's ever said, because I'm not in a religious cult and he's not the leader. So that's the way that is. But
yeah, good thing too.
But really, well-written stuff. I appreciate it. And I thank you for your time tonight. Now, we're going to continue in the next hour. We'll see where we go. But and if you're probably done with me. I know I'm difficult to put up with, and that's all right. That's all right. But
So, Chuck, I mean, I really appreciate the time. It's a very good discussion. It's a pleasure to have, like, you know, to not have to talk in 2-minute sound bites like you have to do for TV and sometimes for radio. So that's a pleasure. And, I appreciate the chance to talk about this. If people want to know more, they can come to my site, to JFK Facts or to Jefferson Morley Books, and I should also say, you know, feel free to reach out if people have comments, want to make contact with me personally. You can do DM me on Twitter. I'm at jeffersonmorley.com. It's probably the quickest way to get to me, or you can email me through my website. So I'm always glad to talk to readers.
Oh, one last thing. You used to have a thing on Jefferson Morley Books where if you wanted a signed copy, you could send a message through there.
Yes. I don't have that yet for Scorpion's Dance, but I will be announcing that soon. We will have, you can get signed copies of The Ghost, my book about James Angleton, through Jefferson Morley Books. And soon I will have Scorpion's Dance autographed copies of Scorpion's Dance for sale as well.
Right.
People should look for this. Look at the site at Jefferson Morley Books for that as well. It's coming right. soon.
I'll tell you something else. If I get in a room with you again sometime in the near future, I might come at you with that and Our Man in Mexico, both of them, to have you sign them in person. Because I usually don't ask for author signatures, but I, but if you see me coming at you with two books in my hand, I'll also have a pen, just so you know.
Okay, forewarned is forearmed, Chuck. Thank
you. There you go. Anyway, Jefferson Morley, and again, the book, I know I've said it a bunch of times, but it bears repeating. Scorpion's Dance, The President, the Spy Master, and Watergate, and indeed, it is an interesting portrait of all those things. And the author is Jefferson Morley, jfkfacts.com, jeffersonmorleybooks.com, and there will be lots of notes in the show description. Stick around. The Ocelli Effect will return after that.
The views expressed by callers, co-hosts, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ocelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ocelli.com or Chuck Ocelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue. Thank you.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply. Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Support Chuck Ocelli at Ocelli.com.
Smoke free. A diversified multicultural postmodern deconstruction is politically, anatomically, and ecologically incorrect. I've been uplinked and downloaded, I've been inputted and outsourced. I know the upside of downsizing, I know the downside of upgrading. I'm a high-tech lowlife, a cutting-edge, state-of-the-art, bi-coastal multitasker, and I can give you a gigabyte in a nanosecond. I'm new wave, but I'm old school, and my inner child is outward bound. I'm a hot-wired, heat-seeking, warm-hearted, cool customer, voice-activated and biodegradable. I interface with my database is in cyberspace, so I'm interactive, I'm hyperactive, and from time to time, I'm radioactive. Behind the eight ball, ahead of the curve, riding the wave, dodging the bullet, pushing the envelope. I'm on point, on task, on message. Off drugs. I got no need for coke and speed. I got no urge to binge and purge. I'm in the moment, on the edge, over the top of under the radar. A high concept, low profile, medium range ballistic missionary. A streetwise smart bomb. A top gun bottom feeder. I wear power ties. I tell power lies. I take power naps. I run victory laps. I'm a totally ongoing Bigfoot slam dunk rainmaker with a proactive outreach. A raging workaholic. A working rageaholic. Out of rehab and in denial. I got a personal trainer, a personal shopper, a personal assistant, and a personal agenda. You can't shut me up. You can't dumb me down. Because I'm tireless and I'm wireless. I'm an alpha male on beta blockers. I'm a non believer and an overachiever. Laid back but fashion forward. Up front, down home, low rent, high maintenance. Supersized, long lasting, high definition. Fast-acting, oven-ready, and built to last. I'm a hands-on, foot-loose, knee-jerk head case. Prematurely post-traumatic, and I have a love child who sends me hate mail. But I'm feeling, I'm caring, I'm healing, I'm sharing. A supportive, bonding, nurturing primary caregiver. My output is down, but my income is up. I take a short position on the long bond, and my revenue stream has its own cash flow. I read junk mail, I eat junk food, I buy junk bonds, I watch trash sports. I'm gender-specific, capital-intensive, user-friendly, and lactose-intolerant. I like rough sex. I like tough love. I use the F-word in my email, and the software on my hard drive is hardcore, no soft porn. I bought a microwave at a mini mall. I bought a minivan at a megastore. I eat fast food in the slow lane. I'm toll-free, bite-sized, ready-to-wear, and I come in all sizes. A fully equipped, factory-authorized. Hospital-tested, clinically proven, scientifically formulated medical miracle. I've been pre-washed, pre-cooked, pre-heated, pre-screened, pre-approved, pre-packaged, post-dated, freeze-dried, double-wrapped, vacuum-packed, and I have an unlimited broadband capacity. I'm a rude dude, but I'm the real deal. Lean and mean, cock-blocked and ready to rock. Rough, tough, and hard to bluff. I take it slow, I go with the flow, I ride with the tide, I get gliding in my stride. Driving and moving, sailing and spinning, jiving and grooving, wailing and winning. I don't snooze, so I don't lose. I keep the pedal to the metal and the rubber on the road.
If you want to play Blind Man, Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Ochilly.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Second hour of the Ochilly Effect begins now at Ochilly.com. And, oh, look at that. We've accidentally played my end music. So I'll just back that up because that's what happens when you're live. Anyways, here we are, a second hour live. And Jefferson Morley was the guest in the first hour. But in the second hour, how about we try this? Maybe you can be the guest. I didn't announce it. I didn't post it anywhere. But if you want to call in, 319-527-5016 is the number to call. And you can talk to me about the interview we just did with Jefferson Morley, or we could discuss whatever's on your mind. That's all fine and dandy. It was a rough weekend in America, and frankly, I want to hear from you. I'd like to hear more of you talking. I got a bit of a sore throat and all this. Had a bit of an allergic reaction earlier today to something. And yeah, so took the last of my allergy medicine and a nap. So honestly, I wasn't in proper form even, but I had to get on the show and do that with Jefferson Morley because it was the second time scheduled and had to get done. Really, it's an excellent book. You know, not just saying it because he showed up, okay? Because if you only knew the people I've already made angry with, yeah, I don't think your book's worth discussing. I don't want to recommend it to my listeners. It's it can get rough sometimes. Anyways, enough of that. Jeff Morley showed up, and we had a good discussion, and I think his book is well worthy. And if you don't believe me, seems like J.G. Michael might agree. I didn't listen to his podcast because I didn't want to have it, interfere with my way of doing things because it might influence me unduly. But J.G. always has a very different discussion, even if he interviews the very same person that I do. And he did a discussion with Morley, I think, that just came out today or yesterday, which I'm sure is different from mine without even hearing it. I can do that. Let's see. You say sight unseen in most cases. What do you say when you haven't heard something? Sound unheard? That doesn't roll off the tongue, does it? Anyways, you can call in 319-527-5016 let me shut up and talk about what you want, if you like. But if not, I guess I'll continue to ramble on. 319-527-5016. So what did we have? A whole lot of action in the daily mass shooter program in America. Do I want to comment on that? Not really. It just simply is what it is at this point. Is it the political football that everybody's making it out to be? Well, it never is, is it? We're supposed to be having public hearings about certain things coming up soon. Do I really want to engage with that? Not really. What is it? Joe Biden. Okay. What? Let's see. They called him Slow Joe. They called him, all right, all kinds of things. Anyway, I saw a weird thing from one of the more extreme extremists in the right-wing alt-media. Now they've got some kind of, like, name for him where I guess there's an agreement that he's in the pocket of China. So it's like, I don't know. They sort of Asianize the name Joe Biden now. I got to pull that up so I can. I thought I had it at the tip of my tongue, and I don't. See, hard to hold things when you're having allergic reactions and taking naps, and you have a wailing headache. So hopefully I did okay with that Morley interview. I don't know. But live radio, that's the way it is. Anyways, yeah, so this is going on in America. Obviously, we do have the anniversary coming up, right? Would be the 50th, I guess, of what was going on there in Watergate. Of course, that's the year I was born. We have it's the anniversary of D-Day. Like I said, we're not doing this day in history, but, you know, there's a bunch of things that happened on June 6th. We have an interesting month anyway when it comes to June as per the recognitions of various anniversary dates and stuff. So who knows what'll come next, not sure how that's all going to go. I've been a little delayed about putting out some of the podcasts, by the way, but I am caught up finally. So, you know, Bob Wilson's show is out. Aaron's show is out from Friday. My show is out from Friday. Weird reactions to the roundtable discussion, because I don't even remember bringing up Johnny Depp, but he probably came up during the Friday night call-in show somehow, and I'm getting messages about that. And I don't know. I guess I'm a traitor to men everywhere because I don't really care that Johnny Depp did well in his case, or did he? I don't even know, because do I care about Amber Turd and the Pirates from the Caribbean guy? Not really. Sorry. I just don't. Anyway, yeah, so I'm a bad guy for that now. The YouTube suspension was lifted, by the way, so now all the shows should be going back to YouTube. Hopefully I can steer clear of the community violations, or guideline violations, I should say, and we'll continue to be over there, even though I'm not sure how much good it's doing me or anybody else. Some people do believe somehow that I only exist on YouTube, but I don't know what to tell you there. you know, there's a lot of other ways to get the show. And the other shows that I'm doing, which I'm doing a reevaluation of the network as well, and what direction we're going to go in here. Because I don't know. I don't feel like it's been all that productive, and I'm not hearing from you guys too much. I know Aaron was on break for quite a while, and some people thought he was gone. I have not elected to get rid of anybody. But some people take breaks, and Jack took off last Thursday. He had things that couldn't be avoided at his time slot, so he decided to skip Thursday. And I have no idea what Jack's plans are. Stop asking me. You know, only Jack knows what Jack's going to do, and I'm just producing his live show. So there you go. I'm not in control of Jack Blood. Never was, never will be, and all that. So anyway, hopefully you guys are doing better out there. I got to tell you that I'm noticing the financial squeeze is not as prominent in the headlines this week as it was last week. I mean, obviously with the mass shooter thing going on, you're not going to get the same coverage on, you know, the thing that's killing us all. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't be covering what's bleeding is leading at this point, because this is significant. But at the same time, I'm sick and tired of hearing about there's going to now be a debate about the guns, and, oh, is it about guns? Is it about mental health? Is it about... I got to tell you that, in my opinion, it is about the soul of what is allegedly a nation. It is about a people divided who are continuously divided strategically by the powers that should not be. And whether you have a gun in your hand, or you're literally attempting to dominate your fellow man or crush your opponents in the circumstance, we're not working together. You understand? We're killing each other anyway and willfully supporting those that kill us. So until you want to address that, I fail to understand where the debate lies. So, you know, with all the virtue signaling about I believe in the Constitution and I believe in what do you actually believe in anything? And by the way, do you understand that you be live in this, right? Because there is a lie in your beliefs always. Your belief means that you don't know something. You ever notice that? Nobody knows anything. If you actually have knowledge, you know it. You don't believe it, you know it. Nobody knows what to do about this toxic element, this need to destroy each other, which appears to be more prolific in this place we used to call America than in other places, frankly. We're quicker to waste a life. We're quicker to destroy things. We're quicker to throw things away and not utilize them fully. We're quicker to do a lot of stuff. And I'm not here to America bash, but, you know, you got to call something like you see it, and this is the way we are. And notice I even say we, and I don't want to. But I know I'm participating in this just like you are, and I think there needs to be a thoughtful reconciliation with your desires to see the world you live in and your ability to act in it. And I am constantly involved in that reevaluation and that attempted reconciliation with what it is I want to see in the world and what it is I'm doing. So, if you're mindful of this in any way, shape, or form, you have to consider it. That's what I'm doing all the time. I'm not saying that I'm successful. I'm not saying that I'm a clean, smart, living individual and on and on and on. But man, I'm trying. I don't know. It doesn't look like everybody is, but I'm trying. And I know a lot of you that listen to this show, a lot of you that listen to the network. I know you're weirdos. You know why you're weirdos? Because first of all, you might actually care about what's going to happen next. You might care about the world you live in outside of what it is you can see only a few feet away from the tip of your nose. You might actually care that there's a resonant effect that is felt by many others when you do certain things. You might care about when you do harm, and you might seek to avoid to do that one way or another, or assist in one, you know, in one fashion that may not even be entirely clear. You might assist. You might be a co-conspirator on a peripheral level because you're supporting stuff that is doing damage to you directly. You're literally paying them in some cases to kill you with, you know, what is the latest toxic thing of the week that the big pharma is going to sell you, that they're going to, you know, make sure that you have enough fear porn to readily clamor for as you seek to have it injected into you. Sure, let's do that. Sure. Or let's participate in making sure that, you know, products that are generated on demand, by demand, are literally the thing that does nobody any good. I mean, it serves its purpose for you, for temporarily, but is there a way to consider these things and get your purposes served without doing damage to so many other people and things? Is that possible? You know, I say this not because you guys, I'm not trying to preach to the choir. Not at all. I'm saying this because consider it. Take a look. Take inventory, they used to say, right? Of what it is that you're participating in on a daily basis. Take a look at what it is that you're voting with your dollars with. Take a look at what it is that you're passively supporting because you have to embrace an antiquated view about some political issue that might be outdated, that might be pointless in the overall debate. Like the constant debate over the guns. Guns are tools. I don't stand on the side of gun control. Matter of fact, I find it to be a distraction, a diversion, an obfuscation of the issue. Because it's not about that. It's not about, well, what about mental health? I guess we need to lock more people up. I mean, there's always that, right? I mean, you know, what do you want when you want more freedom? Let's take the freedom away from others. No, how about you figure out what is actually twisting people, whether it is, you know, a chemical, you know, what was the old animal, vegetable, or mineral, right? Whether it's a chemical reaction because they've been fed something, because there's crap in the water, because there's crap in the air, because the food you eat isn't food. Whether it's that or a general psychological program which has been imposed upon you, whether you agree or not, or whether you think you're a rebel or not. Yeah, the overall atmosphere, the overall interaction with others, which, unless you're a mountain man living on a mountain, and welcome to the show, by the way, and I love those beards. I'm jealous. I can't grow one. Really, I can't. I can't stand, you know, a couple inches off of my chin. It's too itchy. It's way too uncomfortable. I got sensitive skin on my face. So I envy you guys who can do the ZZ Top on the mountaintop, okay? But unless you're one of those guys who doesn't see another human being except, you know, twice a year when he goes into town off of his off-the-grid property to maybe go get some supplies because, you know, can't necessarily manufacture every single thing you need on the mountain. Yeah, unless you're one of those guys, you interact with people. Maybe not personally. Maybe you don't feel it. Maybe you're isolated. Or why am I saying maybe? Almost everybody to some degree is isolated at this point based on the general program that has been introduced culturally from the corporate level. What is the business model? What is the new normal? What is the standardized communication which is acceptable among individuals? Because God help you if you try and talk to anybody face to face. Do you even know how to talk to somebody anymore, or do you just know how to text? I got that question for a lot of people I see. Anyways, you know, if you haven't fallen into the black hole of the electronic milieu and you are hearing the sound of my voice, consider how much of that you're participating in, encouraging, enabling, allowing to persist, literally funding. Literally offering over your data to, literally offering over your body to. Just consider it. I'm not trying to preach. I'm not trying to tell you what to do. I wouldn't. It's not my right. It's not my right to tell anybody what to do. I'm just asking that you examine some of this stuff and see the sometimes hypocrisy, or forget about hypocrisy. Forget about the judgment. Oh, that's just wrong. That's bad. You're doing bad things. You know what? Forget it. Doesn't matter. Good, evil, harm yourself. That's your right. That's fine. But let me ask you, are you being counterproductive to what it is you want to see? Are you actually fighting against the things you want through your own actions, through your own participation, through your own willful acceptance of whatever it is you're doing? Now, I know, on some level, everybody's going to do that. I mean, if I had my choices, if there was a sound alternative that I found to be operationally sound, I wouldn't participate in the monetary system. The decoupling of one's labor and value from things of labor and value to then be reevaluated, repackaged, and then offered up into the sacrificial slave mind of inflationary curves. No, I really would like to avoid using money. But I've got these needs. You see the hierarchy of them, including, you know, food, shelter. And I never look for safety, but food, shelter, and reasonable precautions against things that I know are going to do me harm. Not safety, because safety's an illusion. But the idea that I can keep things clean so that, you know, I don't necessarily get sick, because being sanitary is a good thing. I mean, you know, this time period we went through with all the hand sanitizer and spraying everything with Lysol and, you know, making sure that the stores ran out of rubbing alcohol, so I couldn't get any of that for my first aid kits because people were trying to make their own stuff to spray on everything and cover everything with, and running stores out of Clorox wipes. I know. I'm not saying that, but reasonable sanitation. You know, not necessarily sitting down and eating your food right next to where you've defecated. Things like this. Reasonable behavior that has been learned over time to be more productive than counterproductive. In order to facilitate all that stuff, I need to participate in the monetary system, don't I? I don't like it. I don't like it at all. As I said, the decoupling of value, the decoupling of labor, the decoupling of energy, its value. You can't exchange it directly. You can't just deal with it directly. No, it has to be decoupled and stored in these monetary devices, which, by the way, the only thing that is clear about any particular financial system historically is that eventually they all collapse. But why do they? Because, well, at some point, the introduction in the, let's see, they call that epigenetics when it's a reaction above the genetic and actually causes a reformation of said genetics. Let's call it the epimonetary reaction that occurs when you continuously decouple energy and literal value from itself, pass it around, and distort its meaning, intention, and initial connection to the point where it is beyond recognition. I have literally just described what they do with either paper or coins or well, digital representations thereof, whether they are governmental digital representations of thereof, or, you know, some genius who developed something like a cryptocurrency, it is irrelevant. NFTs, you can have your own. Yeah. It's all the same thing. It is the decoupling of value and energy from the original source of it. And then you're meant to exchange that in order to regain value and energy and things that are needed in that hierarchy of human needs, right? Well, in that case, the middlemen do take advantage of what occurs there and benefit from it without adding to the equation. So you wonder how inflation actually works. An economist won't put it that way, but I don't know. That just seems to be the way I would break it down. Anyway, as I said, when I was asking this question, asking you to consider your participation in what it is you choose to be part of, I know I'm speaking to some people who are like, I do that all the time. Why are you telling me this? Because constant reevaluation and retrospection will be necessary. And not only will there be a need for revolutionary thought and the ability to participate in evolutionary action, but at all times it will take innovation. Innovation for the creation, okay, of anything that is going to get us out of this, depending on who you talk to, slow downward spiral or quick circling of the drain, depending on how you look at it historically, of the systems that be, your quality of life, and the circumstances that we may find ourselves in the future. And the we is, I don't even intend to be here. I'd like my children, and if there is any possibility of grandchildren, I'd like them to be in a place that was better than I inherited. I'd like to leave it better than the way I found it. Some of you maybe don't have kids, you don't care. Well, okay, what do you care about? You care about the quality of your own life, and that's it? Okay. How about we improve that? Could we do that? Is that a possibility? Well, again, without enabling and funding and directly offering oneself up to the various systems which are counterproductive to elevating your own quality of life on a constant basis. And that does include, again, I know, and I make these choices all the time, voting with the dollar and going for a cheap option in order to keep fed. I understand that too. Because at the end of the day, what do you win by making sure that you've had all clean food all the time? You say to yourself, well, I'm healthier, I feel better, but now I'm broke. And I don't actually know anybody personally that can sustain it all the time. Some people are better off, and they can't sustain it. It's not I'm crying poverty here. I've had some financial trials recently that I did not expect. I thought actually I was going to get a turnaround this year. Oh, foolish me to be optimistic about my situation. But I forget my situation. Who cares? Matter of fact, I totally understand why people say, shut up, I don't want to hear about your personal issues, because I don't care about you. And I go, good. You know what? I'm glad you don't. I wasn't supposed to make it this far anyway. So you know what? All bonus time to me, whether it's misery or not. That's fine. Well, what about you? What about you listening to me right now? Are you happy with the circumstance? Do you think things are going well? Are you pleased with your position in life? Are you willing to do anything about it? Again, no judgment. I'm just asking the question. Matter of fact, some people, I believe, honestly, enjoy misery. Some people, I think, enjoy the position of being the victim, of being the sick one, of being the weak one, of being the individual that is to be pitied. I think some people live on pity. You know, Chelly's been reading his psychological books again. No, not actually. I've been trying to catch up on my reading with books relevant to the show. And frankly, it's you want to talk about a losing battle. But either way, I mean, I got halfway through Morley's book, thankfully, but I only got it a couple days ago. And somebody might say, well, you should have gone for the audiobook. Yeah, I think you fail to recognize how long it takes to listen to an audiobook. If you don't listen to them all the time, or if you're doing it just, you know, when you're taking a long drive or you're commuting, it's easy to consume these things when you have long periods of time where nothing else could possibly interrupt it. But until the day that, which probably will never come, until the day I have a separate office from my house and I find a way to streamline my time and set aside to block it out, all those wonderful euphemisms about how the hell you're supposed to shut everybody else out to do something. Until I can actually figure out how to do that, I don't know, for a couple of weeks, yeah, I'm never going to catch up to the stuff I actually want to read, look at, examine. It's going to be a constant thing. Again, no, yeah, who cares about my personal stuff? Let's get back to you. Your considerations. Now, I'm not saying, you know, be the spoiled child of I should have everything I want in the world. No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I think the rarity of receiving the things you want is helpful in not only building character, but in building a realistic viewpoint about the world that will confront you if you engage in it anyway. I'm seeing this in the younger generation. They have a very weird sense of entitlement. And here he goes. Now when is he going to say, these kids need to get off my lawn? And I used to go to the movies for a nickel. Yeah, no. Seriously. There is this sense of entitlement. Like, the way the world is supposed to work, and I know, I have a general sort of complaint that sounds similar, where I say I'd love to get us back to that thing I was told about that was supposed to be this country, this life. That, you know, American dream that many, many people are still sleepwalking through. I'd love to see, not that that is possible and in my hands and that I have it for me, but I'd like to see that it's possible for damn near anybody I know. I'd love to be able to just see success, real upward mobility occur for somebody that I think is doing the right things. And yet, that's not what I see. You want to benefit in the short term? Get your criminality in order. Either get yourself some lawyers so that you can handle your criminal defense, or get yourself some lawyers so that you can exploit others. Get yourself a business model that's simultaneously toxic but extremely beneficial, and as an added attraction, make it so that it is necessary to some other business so that you have an automatic sustainability built into it. And do that, make sure you harm others, make sure that you absolutely crush competition, make sure that you buy off the governments you need to, buy off the law enforcement, joke, the people that are supposed to be regulating you, the people that are supposed to be busting you when you do terrible things, make sure you have those in your pocket, and you're good. You can benefit one way or another. But, yeah, say you don't want to do that, or you're starting from scratch or from divorce, which is less than scratch. If you're coming from an angle where, well, I didn't start out life with anything, nothing was handed to me, I had to go earn it, that's right, okay, I understand this. But if you're starting from there, let me ask you something. Does it work anything like not what you thought it was when you were an ignorant pup? No, I don't want that answer. I want this answer. Does it work anything like it seems at one point, when you didn't find the world to be the place that generates nihilistic intention without effort? When the world was a place where you kind of start to, even if you don't want to support it, understand, people, that do a bit of self-harm because they're constantly participating in things that are counterproductive to their own well-being, longevity, neighbors, everything. They do it willingly, absolutely. They insist on doing it. And you look at it and you go, man, you know what? Even though I think that this is stupidity or hypocrisy, I understand why you're doing it. I really do. Because that's what is appropriate in the world around us. Well, is that where you're at? Is that what you're thinking? I mean, everything's all good. As a matter of fact, yeah, I know I had bad luck, and almost everybody that I know had more than bad luck, and that's okay, because that's just the way it is. Most of us are supposed to get, you know, the crap end of the stick and be grateful for the stick and the crap, right? That's the way it's supposed to work. Okay, that's cool if that's the way you see it. I disagree. I think we can do better. Matter of fact, here's the thing. I don't believe we can do better or think we can do better. Let me correct myself. I know we can do better. And no, I'm not ending the show. But I am going to take a little break. This is Cirrus Minor, Awaiting Dilation. You know, I started listening to that song and I changed my mind. I actually don't want to hear that. I want to put something on that's a little shorter and a little more upbeat. Same band, though. I'll stick with them. This one's called You're Kidding Me on Ocelli.com.
from smoking weed, yeah. You're kidding me. You're kidding me, yeah, yeah, yeah. You're kidding me. You're kidding me, yeah, yeah, yeah. You're kidding me. Smoking weed, yeah. You're kidding me. You're kidding me.
Serious Minor, you're kidding me, on Ocelli.com, on the Ocelli Effect. We're going to leave it in the podcast, I think. So, look, I'm not even going to look at the phone lines anymore because I'll just finish monologuing for the rest of the time on the podcast and just ask the same question over and over again, huh? Which, by the way, I like the refrain on that song. I like the way it bounces. So that's a good mood to set. I like setting the mood a little. And why? Because, again, I'm just going to confront you. I'm going to ask you again. You know, are you considering all the things you're doing? Are you looking at your participation in your own discomfort? Because I'm getting a lot of messages from people that are just increasingly less and less satisfied with what it is they're doing with their lives, with the people they're interacting with. And, you know, I uttered out loud when I was punched in the face on Saturday night. Story, maybe I'll tell you tomorrow. I don't know. I'll think about it. I might go back to telling stories on the show, by the way. I'm thinking, you know, I'll intersperse some guests with that for a little while. Maybe we'll try that. See if we can share some thoughts here. You guys will give me some feedback about it, and we'll see where it goes. Maybe it sucks. Maybe I talk too much, but let's find out. Maybe I'll start doing that more often. Anyway, back to the overall question that I've been asking for not this whole hour, because I gave Jefferson Morley a little extra time, and I'm glad I did, even though, you know, he had a little problem there. He didn't show up recently, and also another time he didn't show up, and I didn't even confront him on it. I didn't confront him on a little incident at the JFK convention. Maybe I'll have him back and do that a few years back. But anyway, cool interview, good book, very solid. I'm not just saying it because he showed up. But anyway, that aside, thanks to Jefferson Morley for doing that. The overall question I've been asking for the majority of what is the second hour of this show today is, are you pleased with what it is the world is presenting you, and are you participating in it? Are you participating in your own unhappiness? And if you are, why don't you stop doing that? Not saying that everything should be based on what's happy and comfortable and wonderful and fuzzy and warm for you, but you're the only one that's going to have a direct influence on that, whether you believe that or not. And I don't want to go, you know, all Marianne Williamson on you here or anything, but the universe will present to you what you ask it for. So I think you should consider it. I think you should look at, are you actively participating in the things that hinder your ability to go through this very short experience that is life without having it be a total and complete misery? Are you making things hard on yourself? I think you need to look at that, because I'm always having to look at it. And you know what? I keep discovering that I'm participating in things that are clearly contradictory, counterproductive, working against me one way or another. I keep discovering that. I'm not perfect. I'm not saying I'm the example. Follow me. I'm asking you to consider the thing that I keep having to constantly consider. Major moral victory when I was struck in the face recently. And I might talk about that tomorrow. I don't know. I'll see what kind of mood I'm in on Tears Day. And also see what Christy Aphrodite's doing, because, you know, she's due to come back on. You know, maybe we'll talk about the things around us and being respectful and observing those things, whether they're growing in plant form or they're growing in nuance as you engage or choose not to engage with the other psychosocial creatures around you, and maybe some of the other creatures too. I mean, oh, by the way, I'm down to four dogs. Take note, we haven't heard them bark or anything. I hope I'm not cursing the last couple of minutes of the show by saying that, but the little doggies seem to be under control, even though one of them's not so little. Anyways, seeking to improve the things around you, you know, eventually, if we're all these little touching radiance that are able to project outward and participate in this, again, very short-term thing that is life, if we're able to do that on a daily basis, then there may be some power and influence that one can have with the very small things that you do, with the things that you literally choose to participate in. And I know some people's choices are very limited. Mine are quite limited, often. I know, very, very first world of me, yes. Talking about my problems as I sit in an air conditioner, and I do wonder what I'm going to eat for dinner, but if I can afford another pack of cigarettes, yeah, I do wonder about that kind of stuff. But very first world, I mean, I have shelter, and I'm fairly confident that I have access to things that are going to make that reasonable, not safety, but that reasonable access to not making my life worse might be at my fingertips at the moment. So do I have a right to complain? I'm not complaining. I'm actually just saying that we can all do better. And how do we all do better? We choose to do better, and we have choices that we make at every moment of every single day. If we were able to make collective choices that actually had us work in concert with one another, if we were able to do these things in a collective fashion so that we could change things, and I'm not talking about voting, because, you know, vote harder if you think the politicians are going to serve you better. I mean, good luck. What level of psychological masturbation does one have to participate in to believe that at this point? I don't know. Because I'm sore already and don't want to play with myself, okay? Even though I'm talking to myself. And you. I mean, you know, in a physical sense, I'm talking to a wall, I'm talking to a microphone, I'm talking to a black screen, which is not black at the moment because it's got my, my software up on it and it's being projected at me and all that good stuff. But I mean, it's not like I observe much of it, and much less than most of you because of my eyesight, so whatever. We're all having our own experience. I just simply ask continuously, are you participating in the things that are productive, positive, and good for you? And if not, why not? And what is it that you can do? Again, I don't have all the answers. I don't have even, I don't know, a good enough number of the answers to say I've got half, a significant minority even probably, of the answers. I don't have them. But I do know that if you work against yourself enough, and I mean in doing any job of any kind, whether it's labor intensive or it's psychological or it's, you know, one of these things I do nowadays, I do know that it often helps to not work against myself with time, with effort, and again, just what it is I choose to participate in. So I offer that for your consideration, and hopefully you have consideration for yourself and your fellow psychosocial, allegedly human being. that you encounter. Let's try that for a bit. And with the shameless little plug at the end here, I just want to say that your help to keep A, the network, B, me, and C, this whole experiment that you might be participating in if you're catching this or any of the other productions that come out through Ocelli.com can all be assisted at any time with your participation by, guess what? Clicking on the PayPal banner, making a donation that way, getting in touch with me, and contributing a resource, an effort, something. Obviously, I don't love money, but money helps. Any of these things to Ocelli.com or me personally, blindjfkresearcher@gmail.com is my PayPal address, or you can click the button on the website. It all helps. I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.